Hiring isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. You need the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. If you want candidates who truly match what you're looking for, trust Indeed Sponsored Jobs. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post stands out to quality candidates who actually fit the role. According to Indeed data, 90% are more likely to be hired and trusted by 1.6 million companies. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. Now with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help your job get the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcast13. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast13. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome back, everyone, to Vox Markets Live. My name is Paul Hill, and I'm delighted again to be able to speak to accomplished UK fund manager Dominic Weller of Octopus Investments. So big welcome, Dominic.
Morning, Paul. Great to be here.
Yeah, well, it's fantastic to have you back on the show. Lots been happening since we last spoke 9 months ago, not least, obviously, the Trump trade tariffs, the ongoing war in Ukraine. And then we've got the Damocles swords of the budget in 3 weeks' time. So putting all that together, what's your sort of your best view for UK equities over the next 12 months?
Yeah, it's been a really interesting market, as you said. Sort of the larger cap index has done very well indeed globally and relatively, but small caps overall have still been left behind significantly from a valuation perspective and from a performance perspective. So we still see a lot of opportunity in small cap land, and we're running, of course, multi-cap strategies across a lot of the different funds we run, very comfortable going down the market cap scale. And I continue to think that the biggest risk, just as we've gone through reporting season as well, is that businesses are getting taken over on the cheap, and we continue to see that. And so the budget is going to be important. I think the government understands that inflows into this asset class are super important. That's been sort of highlighted in the Mansion House speech and in other occasions as well. And finding ways to really get inflows back into UK small caps is going to be super important, in my opinion. It doesn't take a lot. It's, relatively speaking, a very small asset class. I think actively managed funds in this space are about 10-ish billion in size. So it doesn't take a lot at all. Of inflows into this asset class to really drive valuations up, and yeah, that's I think what we're hoping for.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. I mean, small cap UK equities have been hugely undervalued, as evidenced by the amount of M&A and how companies are being taken up. In fact, probably find the acquirers are the biggest inflows into small cap equities over the past 12 months. But you guys have done pretty well, actually. Let's just go to one company that's been shooting the lights out, Boku, over sort of long term. It's a sort of like international or local payments provider, does a lot of sort of billing, direct carrier billing onto telcos, but it's branched out to other services like digital wallets and all other sort of like applications for largely Asian consumers out in that part of the world. What's your sort of your latest on this one? Because it really has sort of like done phenomenally well.
Yeah, I think that was my favorite stock last time. So at least that one I got right, which was good. It's as you say, it started out predominantly in direct carrier billing, giving sort of these mega merchants access into these markets through essentially being able to pay for these services using your mobile phone. And as these payment ecosystems have developed, they sort of leapfrogged us and the US, sort of cutting out cards, which are very cumbersome, have lots of issues for the merchants, and have gone to more direct payment methods and wallets, which are dominating in those markets. Now, these are massive markets and potentially massive growth markets for some of these big merchants. And having access and very simplified access into these payment ecosystems, I think, is a massive value proposition. And Boku is the leader in that space. So in that way, I think it has done really, really well. And you can look at it. They break out local payment methods in their reporting, and it's really growing and compounding significantly. If we sort of take a look from here where it can go, I think overall it's still tiny in sort of the payments market is absolutely massive. And sort of the key growth levers that they can pull is deeper merchant penetration, even just with their existing merchants. They're only really scratching the surface. So if they work with an Amazon in one market, you know, just penetrating that out from just, let's say, Amazon Prime into a lot of additional verticals and additional markets, that could really go. In a recent Capital Markets Day, they also highlighted that they can really grow merchants, especially with sort of the new AI wave. We get a lot new merchants that are making very significant revenues in this space. So there's no reason why they couldn't work with some of those merchants to facilitate growth in some of those geographies and payment methods. And then they can also innovate on their product offering, like optimizing on FX. They talked a little bit about stable coins, which has sort of been all the rage in terms of moving money across borders, which is of course something that Boku does significantly. So they're really well positioned, and I think Stuart and Rob have done really well as a team. They're super incentivized, and I think this is such a valuable asset, and it's fantastic to have that listed on the market here. And so sort of having long-term shareholders like us and sort of supporting it through space.
Do you know why it doesn't pay a dividend, which just seems odd because it's obviously generates a shed load of cash. Is there a specific reason it just wants to sort of like, I don't know, redeploy all the funds straight into its capital base, into its own organic growth, I guess, but I was just interested.
Yeah, the cash figure is not all of their cash, so it looks right. A little bit optically high. Some of it is sort of in-system stuck merchant cash, so that's one thing to mention. Fundamentally, I think they want to reinvest into their product portfolio, growing out, and right now really are, in terms of their sort of capital allocation strategy, in growth mode, and really want to sort of go and deliver that growth. I guess a lot of their international competitors and sort of broad category peers that you could take into are investing huge amounts of money. And so I think they really want to be out there investing and driving those returns. So that's sort of one of the key reasons why at the moment they're not paying a dividend.
Okay, I don't know whether you own it, but got Drew is asking similar company. Well, it's a company in the similar sort of sector, Wise, which does obviously the foreign payments, consumer orientated. Doesn't really across the world, but I'm actually a customer. I love the service. But do you own it, or do you got any thoughts on Wise at all for Drew?
Yeah, I own Wise as well. And have done for a while. Business really I admire. I've been a customer since I first moved here about 10 years ago, I think. Originally it was just still called TransferWise. It's fundamentally, I think, set in a really interesting space. It's one of those businesses that's serving customers incredibly well and solving a really important problem. I think what we've really seen and what's been the big growth driver for this company is moving from a pure consumer product into a more established professional product where big banking partners are actually using this to move the money around. So that infrastructure that they've built, I think, has become really, really valuable. I think the key question, of course, for this name as well is going to be the stablecoin, because we've seen such strong regulatory support in the US, and then a significant amount of innovations, and we've got some startups that are trying to tackle this whole problem from that perspective, where money now potentially is going to move on the stablecoin rails rather than in the banking system rails potentially. This is all still early stage, but I think it's worth sort of focusing in on this. And I think a lot of the commentary on Wise has been about that. I think it's also going to be interesting how they're potentially going to go for their banking license. So what impact that's going to have on the interest income economics that the business has. So at the moment they have this strange luxury where they couldn't really pay interest to their customers and use that in a way to really heavily invest. But that those are, I think, two dynamics, I would say, to look at and to try to really understand in underwriting the long-term investment thesis for this business. But fundamentally, incredible business, incredible traction, one of a kind management team, I own it.
You're going to hold it. I mean, I as a customer, and my actual own business, PMH Capital, is a customer as well. I have my sort of like linked accounts. It's fabulous. It really is a great service. So I can't tip my hat enough. Okay, good. In the same sort of sector, we've got Emma. She's asking about PCI Pal, which basically does sort of secure payment technology and software for contact centers. And obviously, there's a lot of change happening in contact centers in terms of upgrading with AI and agentic agents that they're putting in that will be able to take payments. And it's really sort of getting their head around the whole thing with PCI Pal, because now going through an investment phase, having just reached profitability as well. But all in the round, what's your sort of your latest view on the company?
Yeah. We've been really long-term investors in this one when they originally still had a contact center business and sort of went out and went on their cloud journey. And James has done, in my opinion, an unbelievable job running this business and growing it. If you look at the numbers, their revenue has actually compounded at about 35% per year for the last 5 years. It's not a small feat, really, in terms of what they've done from that perspective. Plus, they went through a really difficult phase where they had a patent case from a competitor, which took up so much bandwidth and capital and was really, really hard for the business, which is behind them now. So we're now at a point, I think, where this company, as you say, has sort of one of the leading cloud platforms for these secure payments within this environment. And in my opinion, they're integrated with all the sort of all the key AI native solutions in this space. Their product development is going into that direction. And I think they, given their product development and their sort of partner ecosystem that they're plugged into, they're primely positioned to capitalize on that if that is where the world is going significantly. And if not, they've got the sort of key solution within this space. But just from the basics, that now doing about 20 million of ARR, they're still growing really strongly, have good balance sheet, and trading at about 1.2 times sales or something like that. The cheapest peers are trading on 4 or 5 times sales, and you should see that operational leverage kicking in. Although we will have a little bit of an investment phase going through, but. So I think they've gone through so many difficult situations and managed that so well throughout that I feel like it is the time to sort of stick with it and to support them here to continue to execute on this. And it's, I think, from a valuation perspective and from a positioning perspective, I think in a really nice place. Plus, they should be able to, through their partner ecosystem, really go out and grow the story. So that's sort of the key reason why I'm sort of investing in this one.
And just on the sort of longevity of contact centers per se, because you're hearing a lot now of the likes of OpenAI and ChatGPT who are putting together these sort of e-commerce solutions with payment rails such as Stripe, and they just announced one, I think, last week with PayPal, where they do one click straight through processing. And it's just an example. I asked for some sneakers or something. What's the best sort of quality sneakers to buy for under 100 quid or whatever? And then it comes out with one recommendation that admittedly you've got to be able to trust. And then you just hit a button and it goes all the way through rather than having to go through a contact center. I just wonder, what's your sort of view just overall in the industry of contact centers?
Yeah. Well, I think a lot of it is going to be also interactions where you might have to deal with more complex purchases. So whatever, if you buy furniture online or stuff like that, a lot of those will be done through the phone. Of course, it is a sort of declining market in a way, but also you've got the other side of the coin as well, where you might call and you order the wrong size and sort of the refund needs to be processed through the contact center. So customer service, as I think, still going to be strong. And if it is done through AI, you need to have that secure channel through, which is what PCI Power is working on and building. So that is the thesis behind it. And I think on that, consumer behavior tends to change a little bit slower than anticipated, I think, especially where there's these edge cases where you will need some level of interaction. Even if it's done by an agent, it will need to be processed in a compliant way. It won't be carved out of the legislation. And so why not buy the sort of best cloud native easy plugin that does it for you? Feels conceptually quite doable.
Yeah, particularly where you get sort of complex offers, I don't know, insurance, and has to be tailored to yourself. Yeah, no, I'm with you. Okay, good. Let's move to cybersecurity. We've got GB Group, which has been an AIM darling in the past. It basically allows companies to verify who an individual is before they make a sort of transaction, also onboarding that consumer into sort of like a fintech, into somebody like, you know, I don't know, Revolut or Monzo or people like that. Plus it does location verification of that individual. So it should be the perfect sweet spot for all of this AI impersonation and pretending to help counteract that sort of potential fraud. However, having said that, it hasn't yet come through in the numbers of late. I think they've had a bit of an overhang in the States. Overall, what's your view on this? The shares look remarkably cheap for a tech business in such a hot space.
Yeah, I think it's a business that had a few things going against it. Sort of FX has really been negative for them. As you say, the US had been slow and not been going that well. You had a legacy contract in the UK, which been a massive drag on margins. And then also you had that technical situation. As you said, it was an AIM darling, but it no longer is. And then that creates quite a tricky technical situation for the stock in the short term. So I think that was a reason as well why they are where they are. Fundamentally, I think, as you say, it's trading on a very, very cheap valuation, sort of 8% free cash flow yield on 12 times PE. I mean, I remember the stock on 50 times PE.
Yes, so do I.
A long time ago. And, you know, like you looked at Onfido, which was sort of their closest UK peer. They were private, heavily loss-making. They got taken out on 4.5 times sales. And GB is sort of in the market there. It's trading at a huge discount to sort of the other peers on the market as well, and arguably has really good IP, really good data that they own, and so should be quite valuable from that perspective. So it's really frustrating where it is here. But I think, as you say, that you've got the valuation and to look at, and you have potential catalysts as well. So you know, the US sort of showing some green shoots now. They've launched a new sort of more product ties. I don't know if that's a word, but more like a well-defined product called GBG Go, which is easier to be bought. And that has shown really good traction with some early customers and fintech. So that could be a catalyst. And at the moment, sort of, I think the risk reward is really, really attractive, the way it's trading. So they could also hopefully go on a slow upgrade cycle from here as well, where with the numbers being in the right place and starting to deliver some top line organic growth, which is what we need in the stock. But yeah, where it's here, I think, yeah, it's in a really interesting spot.
Yeah. I had a sort of like my own sort of thesis, which I haven't been able to verify. So you may be able to help me here. In terms of their pricing, their product, the whole sector is growing in sort of like 10%, 12%, even up to 15% around the world. So it's slowed. It's low double digits. These guys are like for likes now, if you strip out one-offs, is about 4%. And they've been sort of like low single digits. Is that sort of like they've been, you know, normalizing their pricing because they may have been, you know, they're early mover and they probably, I'm just, my own thesis is that they were perhaps priced sort of like below the market, sorry, above the market, and the market, or the market's got more competitive, and therefore they've seen volume growth, but not as much sales growth because pricing has been slightly negative. And on that basis, if that's correct, then once they've fully normalized, which is probably about now, they should then re-energize and go back to low double digits. But I don't know whether you've got any feel for their pricing versus their competition, particularly in that pay-as-you-go aspect out in the States.
It's really hard to say as well, because they acquire different businesses and then tailor their offering depending on the different size of the business. So it's very hard to get the visibility onto that. I don't think there's any evidence to argue with this thesis. I think it's possible for sure.
Yeah.
But it's hard to have the visibility on that, given sort of the movements in product portfolio, re-innovation in the product portfolio, and then changes of targeting. It's what we've seen.
Okay, well, I'll ask any of the audience listening now, if you have the answer to that one on GB Group, put it into the chat bot and I'll be able to read it out. Okay, let's move to hardware tech. We've got one of the darlings, one of the successful IPOs of the last couple of years, Raspberry Pi, the sort of like iconic cheap computing expert in the UK, sort of like targeted originally for sort of like enthusiasts and school kids doing sort of like mini computers, and now specialized into full boards and into chips and expanded out into corporates. The shares have come off, actually, even though the business has done pretty well. How do you see this one going forward? Is this in value territory now? Because the shares are actually about half of where they were.
Yeah, it's one of those businesses where it's just amazing to meet the team and meet Eden. Yeah. I mean, it's a company that I've admired for I don't know how long, and then sort of seeing it come to market. And sort of giving the public access to this company is amazing in terms of the impact the company and the foundation has had overall. I think it's been incredible. And in a way, it's been bootstrapped for a very, very long time. In terms of the thesis on that one is that if you can provide really cheap high performance compute into everyday life and into industrial processes, you can really drive a lot of value. And that's fundamentally what Raspberry Pi does, be it through microcontrollers or indeed their single board computers. The opportunity set is incredibly high for them, especially from OEM customers, where the traction has been really good. And they're adding a lot of additional growth in there. And once these are built into products and into processes, it's incredibly sticky and really valuable. And I think you've got a company here that can really control the entire stack, which not a lot of companies in the world can do that. It's maybe an Apple and Nvidia, but also a Raspberry Pi, and which I think is really, really impressive. I think what we've had here is, if you look at storage prices, memory prices have gotten absolutely vertical. It's one of the craziest charts. I mean, in our international mandates, we focus on SK Hynix and Micron, which provide these, and they're some of the best performers that you could possibly have in your portfolio.
Is this DRAM? Is it DRAM?
Yeah, it's DDR4, DDR5, yeah. Exactly. And that has a negative impact on someone like Raspberry Pi, who has to buy these, and of course they had to put through some price increases on compute module as a result of that. And this has been essentially the sort of some of the weakness that we've had. Arguably, the shares also just got previously really, really excited and probably got a little bit ahead of themselves when they had a ace in front. But I think in the long term, it's one where you just it's in the really long. This is a business that's really run for the long term. Founder owned, and we it's going to invest into the next compute platform. It's going to get embedded into these key processes. And want to sort of just have on your list and keep monitoring, I think, as it's just given its really uniqueness in the market.
It reminds me of Arm, actually, in terms of, but it's actually, when you look at it on an EV sales basis, I know its margins are a lot less, but it's very, very cheap, and what it's priced by the market is totally different to how it is perceived and priced in the private markets, because it's, yes. You're right, it's a platform, isn't it? It basically does its computing stack. It is a one-to-many model rather than just an individual all the time, I guess. But
absolutely, and the leverage is coming through there, of course, as you grow.
Yeah. Okay. Good. Well, we've got Harry. He's asking about. No, sorry. We've got Stuart. Sorry. He's asking about Insilica, which is a semiconductor business that does mainly sort of like customized chips. Came out with quite an upbeat trading statement today, but it does for sort of like large OEMs of their specific applications around the world. It's getting a bit short of cash, or it was when we last spoke, and I think still is to a certain extent, but hasn't raised. I don't think it's raised, or maybe it's topped up some money. What's your sort of view on Insilica? But it rather than the platform, it's more sort of like sort of customer specific tailoring chips. I think.
Yeah, it's a business essentially that went from being a consulting business, so big OEM. Needs a chip, and they essentially got paid for their design services, into becoming a company that takes the risk on the chip, essentially designs it, and well, not the risk, but as in like tries to own the entire stack throughout and build into supply contracts. So their expertise really is mixed signal ASICs, so specific chips to applications, which is really important in sort of space communications, and that's where their key wins have really been. They've had six programs right now, which are progressing really nicely, which, as you said, they've highlighted this morning. Signed two new feasibility studies into this space. The difficulty with this is it's really hard to manage, as you say. It's working capital intensive, and it's quite lumpy, as in these contracts move around a little bit depending on capacity and on progress. And that has made it quite challenging, I think, to manage it and for the public markets to forecast it, because it's just really tricky. Fundamentally, I think, as they are so well embedded within, so I think the demand for these types of chips, mixed signal ASICs, is going to increase significantly. They're one of the leaders in this space. And sort of the key thesis is that as the cost to orbit decreases, the need for these chips is going to sort of explode, and from more and more players are looking to going to enter that market. Now, it will require really strong execution from the team there, and it is one of the sort of more difficult businesses, I think, to manage in terms of the dynamics and the requirements that it has. And I think that's sort of reflected within the share price and where it's trading today. So it's I think it's on the higher risk, higher reward side of the portfolio, more sort of a satellite position.
Yeah, it probably needs to buy somebody or get, to bulk up so you sort of iron out some of the individual ups and downs of each of the products and the customer requirements, I guess, those big cycles.
Well, once you have a couple of chips in supply, and you're sort of making basically covering the cost base of the business through a few chips that are doing well, where you've got long-term revenues, five years, whatever, production revenues, and you can cover the cost base. I think at that point, it the model de-risks significantly, but you have to go over that hump, which is the challenging bit.
Okay, good. Let's move to sort of industrials. We've got We've got Frank. He's asking about a real success for you again is Volution, which does all things sort of like fans. About 70% of the business, I think, is in consumer houses and improved ventilation and HVAC and all this sort of stuff. But then the rest of it's into corporates, I believe, yeah. Specialist kitchens and stuff like that. Shares have rocketed. Have done really, really well, which is for a industrial company is incredible. But I suppose the question really for Frank, you know, is have we reached peak fan given we've had such a hot summer, but or just keep like Boku, just keep running the winners on this one?
Yeah, I think the opportunity set for them still remains really high. It's such a consolidated market, and here you've got a really strong consolidator in this space, having proved their acquisition pedigree over and over again. Their latest deal was really good as well, and it's making really good progress. But their organic growth that they're putting down on the tape is really impressive, as you say, because the end markets are really tough. What we're seeing from sort of global domestic, it's quite tough. But the opportunity, I think, remains, especially on the inorganic side. And if they can maintain somewhat this level on the organic side, I think there's still significant compounding to go for. As you say, evaluation towards the top end of the range here, sort of 17 times, which arguably is on the higher side relative to its historic average. However, I do think the quality of the business has also improved throughout that period of time. Fundamentally, you're backing a management team to go and continue on that organic growth and continue on the consolidation opportunity within the industry. They're really nicely diversified from a geographic perspective as well. So that's where we are. I mean, we are running it for now. I think it's in a good space. It's sitting within our sort of building a sustainable planet vertical. And I think it's in a really interesting position now.
Okay, good. We got, I don't know where you own it, but James Beswick is basically asking about Optima Health, which is an occupational healthcare company, sort of tech enabled. I think it was spun out of Marlowe. And I know some other sort of like professional investors have jumped on board and stuff like that. I guess they're probably secular growth drivers is getting the NHS waiting list down and all of the sort of like the number of people who have got, you know, sort of mental health and physical health problems in companies to get them back into the workforce. But do you say any words on Optima Health? Do you own it at all?
We own it. We're shareholders in it. I don't own it in my fund, so I don't know in this fund, but fundamentally, really, really positive opportunity. I remember meeting this business when it looked to IPO and then did an IPO and sort of got, as you said, consolidated. So it's been a really long journey having known this business.
Yeah,
I think we're going through this period now where they're out there delivering and getting sort of their own story told to the market. As you said, it was part of another business spun out. Having to go through that transition period, and then now getting their first sort of sets of results on the books and are delivering. So we as a team are really supportive of the business here, they've had a statement out today as well, which looked all right. So we are supporters of that one, but I don't own it in my fund. So
okay. Okay, good. Well, let's stay in the sort of the healthcare for life sciences area. Let's go to sort of like a fantastic little business called Ixico that I know you talked about last time. Basically, does analysis of all things MRIs and image scans for neurodegenerative diseases, Huntington's and Parkinson's and Alzheimer's. And actually, since we last spoke, it was involved in that sort of like to the breakthrough treatment for help discover for Huntington's and likewise for a new sort of diagnostic in Alzheimer's. But anyway, how do you see the business? It's seems to be making decent progress from what you said last time.
Yeah, it's one we own in our VCTs and have done so for a really long time. In a way, the neurodegenerative disease research is going through cycles, which makes this super, super hard initially. So this company enjoyed quite a positive time in the past, and then lost a big phase three trial, and it sort of was really quite hard to manage. You had a new CEO come in, and I think Bram and Grant have done such an incredible job with the company, diversifying it across further neurodegenerative diseases and potentially other diseases. So driving the capability out, investing in the tech platform, really growing the sales pipeline and the sales function there to really embed with these trials at an early stage. And I think that's really driving positive outcomes now. They had a capital markets day last week, that we attended, and they had a sort of terrifying stat in there that 43% of the global population will be exposed to a neurological disease. So it's a huge problem. The science for it is incredibly hard, but as you said, there's been some real breakthroughs, and it always goes in these cycles where there's a breakthrough and then there's a lot of research going into it. Biomarkers are being embraced, the trial pipeline is shooting up, and then you go through a trickier phase again, and sort of you go up again. And I think we're sort of right now at one of these inflection points where it looks like the activity is really picking up again, and Ixeko is so well positioned in this space. Plus, you've got an amazing management team in there. Growing revenues now double digits. It's really good order book, 14 million or so, and nicely positioned there. So we are in, and obesity is really excited about it.
Yeah, it's only 11 million market cap, trading at about 1.1 times sales. So it's just not on the radar for many people. But anyway, Okay, another fantastic life science company. Let's go to Diaceutics, which basically does all things sort of like helping large pharma commercialize their precision medicines, whether it's in sort of like cancer or immunotherapy, et cetera, around the world. It's just like a CRO picks and shovels play. Its top line is really motoring, strong double digit. How do you see this one progressing?
Yeah, it's fundamentally addressing that problem of treatment gaps, where a lot of individuals might be tested for something, but then not prescribed the correct treatment potentially. And by connecting to the lab network in the US, Diaceutics bridges that gap and creates really a win-win where the patient gets the treatment at a faster time and the right treatment at the right time. And that's sort of the fundamental value proposition from this business, especially in diseases where it's really hard to find the right treatment, where you potentially have just a genetic marker that makes you eligible for that treatment, and tend to be really quite expensive treatments as well. They're also branching into new disease areas now, so really well positioned. It's one again, which way Ryan is incredible product vision for this company. I remember I went to Northern Ireland quite a few years ago now. At that time, Peter was still running the company, and Ryan was running all the sort of product development for their platform, SaaS platform, which at that point was just being launched. Before that, it was more consulting business and then transitioned. But so that vision, and now, as you say, the top line revenue is really accelerating. It's all coming from that platform, it's been one of the really big success stories there. They do have quite a bit of work to do in the second half. If you do the maths, yes. but they have done quite well. Have a solid balance sheet as well. Have just gone through a really comprehensive investment phase, and they're now really looking to deliver on that opportunity set, given the investment that they've made. So that's where we're seeing it, and I like the space, and I think they are in a good space. It's one of the areas that the FDA remains quite positive on, precision medicines, that is.
Okay, good. Let's stay in the same sector. A couple of ones which are a bit of a harder. The harder times, particularly when in the FDA's sort of like firing line. We've got hVIVO, which does human challenge trials largely for sort of like people developing new vaccines and antivirals. It's got a very new facility in London, I think it's in Canary Wharf, that does these trials. And obviously with the head honcho there in healthcare, all things healthcare out in the States, Kennedy doesn't seem to like vaccines, which has knocked the development of vaccines and antivirals. And obviously it's fallen. Anyway, putting it all together, shares now have more than sold off, look very, very cheap. What's your sort of view on that particular business and the long-term opportunity there?
Yeah, I think last time I was on, I said you investors have to assess the risk from Kennedy versus sort of the opportunity set and how much it's going to impact pharma development. And I think it's fair to say that I got that wrong, how much the activity has subsided in the short period of time. So it really, the development has really fallen off a cliff of that area, which is really sad to see in infectious diseases. And it is a really tough period. What's good to say is that they have diversified their revenue base. They've acquired some businesses, so they're quite well diversified. And I think it's not a permanent shift, but it's really operationally leveraged, as you said, because they've got the site and they've got the opportunity to run these. I think in a way, this is quite cyclical as well. We tend to get very strong infectious disease research, and then you get periods of this underperformance. I think this has been more pronounced than originally anticipated, I think it's fair to say, and quite remarkable in fact how quickly that this has changed. But I think it can snap back in the other direction at some point as well. In the meantime, as you say, the company is trading on a very, very cheap valuation. But it's going through really, really tough times. I think you've got Mo as a good, really good operator in there, and you know, they have diversified through different acquisitions into the space, but it's one that's just going through a really hard time. I think it's there's no other way of putting it. It's just really challenging when sort of the research activity pauses for a period of time and then before the triggers are being pulled again. There are some catalysts there that could potentially wake the company up again, but yeah, in the meantime it's going through a tricky period.
It's crazy, isn't it, how the world desperately needs vaccines and vaccine development for all kinds of conditions, and then we've got the guy at the top of America who doesn't like vaccine. I mean, that's just crazy. It really is, but hey-ho, such is life. Okay, let's go to, we've got to Stefan. I don't know whether you own this one, AOT, which I think does sort of wound management for sort of like diabetic foot out in the States. It's proprietary medical device, I think, treats a lot of the military veterans and sort of older people with diabetes out in the States. Sales are going well, but the share price has not actually reflected that at all. I don't know whether you own it at all. Do you just do anything? No, I don't own it.
I don't own it. No.
Okay, no problem at all. Let's go to one in the energy sector, low carbon energy sector and hydrogen power. We've got Ceres Power, which I think came out with a positive announcement this morning as well. Been a darling during the lockdowns, then the shares got corrected. I think one of its largest partners and strategic players, Bosch, decided to leave last year. But having said that, from that moment, that was the bottom for the shares, and the shares have almost doubled. So, putting it all together then, Ceres Power, how should investors look?
Way more than doubled. I mean, they were 50p, they're £3 now.
Oh, okay, right. Yes. How should investors look at Ceres Power?
I think the reason why this company is, as you said, solid oxide fuel cells. It's an IP model, so licensing royalty model. It was really terrible, I think, that Bosch exited that space, and then they were a huge shareholder as well, board seat, and sort of decided we exit that spot. And that's why the shares were so down. I think you now have Doosan, which is a South Korean company, starting their rollout. And fundamentally, I think where this company is solid oxide fuel cells, potentially, can solve a real important problem within the AI data center space. You've got a US peer, which is called Bloom Energy. They actually manufacture the systems and sort of are more asset heavy business, but they have started to make big deals with AI data centers because it can progress, it can process a range of different fuels and hydrogen, and is super energy efficient and, as you say, low carbon in doing that. So the Bloom Energy is up about sixfold, I think, year to date. Mm. And I think, I mean, you compare just the absolute size against these Ceres has some real, you know, from a pure tech perspective, has some real exciting opportunities there. And I think it's just lagging behind that a little bit in terms of once investors see that. And if Ceres can get some deals like that through its OEM partners, the demand for it could be quite quite significant. And I think that's what investors have been waking up to slowly, and hence why you've seen such a sort of violent move in the share price. Now it's still only, call it, 500 million market cap, and you know the space is absolutely massive. Their IP is sort of second to none in this space, and yeah, so that's I think where it comes into place. I think. Yeah. That's where it's quite interesting. Also, well, the alternative is, of course, a gas turbine, but basically impossible to buy gas turbines right now. They're sold out until 2030. GE Vernova, Siemens Energy, you can't buy it. It's impossible. Right. And these companies, they can't really put on a lot more additional capacity. So if you're building a data center and you need to get on in 2027, 2028, you're going to build a little microgrid, and solid oxide fuel cell could be part of stack. It's very scalable, very reliable, and flexible in their fuel source could be a good opportunity there. And I think that's why we're seeing it.
Yeah, they can. So my understanding then, I mean, not only can those solid fuel cells be used to generate hydrogen or use hydrogen, they basically can also be used natural gas, and that's what you're saying, is that you can't get a gas turbine. So these guys, you can get one of their particular products, and therefore that will generate enough electricity for your data center powered by natural gas. Is that right?
Yeah, so the fuels, exactly. The fuel cell generates electricity from a range of different sources. The electrolyzers, they would generate the hydrogen, which would sit on the other side. But Ceres always was a fuel cell specialist and then moved into electrolyzer for a while. Still do, but it's on the fuel cell side, I think, where it's really quite interesting.
Right. Yeah. No, I can definitely see why the shares have done well in that case. Probably got lots of American investors piling in, I respect. Look at that, right? There's an arbitrage opportunity in Bloom and Ceres. Okay, yeah. Sarah's got a question on Trainline. Asking about your thoughts there. Basically, it's a tech company that does really sort of like is a broker, ticket billing, really, across the UK and internationally, growing into selling tickets to corporates and longer distances overseas. Being hit recently, though, by the introduction of the Great British Railway and also expansion of the TfL pay-as-you-go scheme as well, which has taken down, and the commissions have come down. So all in the round, how do you see Trainline progressing?
Yeah, I think sentiment, as you say, really hit by that. You've got fears around competition from the likes of Uber. You've got the railways bill, which is going to come out probably a couple of weeks' time. And you have pay-as-you-go, as you say, as a potential, people think that could be a risk to it. This one, it's a platform business. It's, in my opinion, really high quality. They just announced a trading update where they beat an upgraded guidance again. It's trading on less than seven times EBITDA, and it's buying back shares so aggressively. So it's returning a significant portion of the market cap every year just through its buyback. So it's, I just think it's never a good reason to buy a company. It's so cheap, and I just think that my opinion is that the fears are overblown on it. I don't see the execution from I think it's going to be very difficult to disrupt this monopoly through, well, not a monopoly, but as in the, this technology and this, the consumer behavior in this space. In the UK, in Europe, they continue to grow, and it works amazingly well. In Europe, you've got that the exact opposite movement happening in Europe at the moment, where all these lines are being liberated. I mean, Germany is a huge opportunity, which hasn't started yet. I mean, Spain is doing really well, and Spain works amazingly. If you go and take a train in Spain, do download your train line app. It's going to make it so much easier for you. And I think it's one where you close your eyes and buy it, and you know, I think these concerns will go away, and then you get a completely different valuation for this company, because it's sort of valued at terminal decline, and my thesis is that it's not, and that they're going to continue to provide a lot of value, be it through pay as you go and through other products. So yeah, it's really interesting one, because it's really exposed to that sort of regulatory risk and government intervention in this space. But it's just, I think it doesn't reflect the quality of the company where it is.
Yeah, the profit margin 28%. So I mean, there's obviously got it's doing very well for itself, and as you know, as a platform stock. And just as anecdotal evidence, so I was actually in Berlin when you mentioned about Germany about a month ago, and we were using Trainline to book our train tickets. So it has definitely got that. You know, it's very easy and it's very visible for people to use. Okay, let's move sectors. We've got Jeff. He's asking about Itaconics, which I think does sort of all natural plant based sort of like additives that go into cleaners, they go into personal products, they go into things like I don't know, cosmetics or whatever. But they've how do you see this one?
Well, it's also a real tiddler, a really, really small company.
Yeah.
I think like 9 million EV, they've got like $5 million cash on the balance sheet. And yet it's one of those businesses where the greener solution is better and cheaper, and when investing into this sort of this space, I think that's what you need. That's where companies can really create value, but it takes a long time. They had the interims out, you know, revenues grew 70% odd to about $5 million. They've got really key strategic partnerships with the likes of Groda, which they've just extended, and they're getting designed into these formulations, which takes a really long time to win these customers. But then once you're in, you're in. So I think it's not reflective to the value of where this company is in terms of the performance that it could potentially generate. At the moment, it's just like nobody's looking at it. For that reason, it's sort of trading at such a low valuation. It looks like it's going into the right direction. It's funded, so there's no worry around that. Yeah. And the momentum should be there from a top line perspective, hopefully. And the key partnerships are in place to make this a success. So, yeah,
what's stopping the adoption if it's sort of cheaper and functionally better than the normal equivalents in the chemical variety?
It is being adopted. They have a massive customer which made up about 40% of their revenue, and they couldn't agree on margins on that product, and they walked away from that contract. And sort of rebuilding from losing a 40% customer has been brutal and a really hard period, and that's why you see sort of that bounce back as well. But I think it comes down to as well, like, you know, it's like negotiation, right? When you're at that point, you think you can probably get them. Versus they sort of stood their ground and said, no, this is not building a sustainable business here, and we're going to grow this over time, and that's what it did.
Yeah. Okay, good. Let's switch sectors. We've got I don't know if you own it, but Adam is asking about M&C Saatchi. I don't know if they came out with a statement today saying that they've had one of their divisions approached by a competitor, Brave Bison. Do you own it at all? Any thoughts on M&C Saatchi as the advertising agency?
Yeah, no, we own it. I don't own it in my fund as a team. We've sort of been investors for this in this one for a long term. Really like the business. It's gone through a long period of making it operationally lean, I guess is the right way of putting it. And I think is sitting in a really nice space. Fundamentally think it's in a really good position and like it as we're big supporters of it as a team.
Yeah, I think it's, as a breakup value, some of the parts, it's a lot higher than it currently is valued at, isn't it? It seems to suggest from what happened this morning with Brave Bison. Okay, we've got Colin. Let's go to, he's basically asking about Renew Holdings that does essential services for things like nuclear facilities in the UK, also for the rail sector, which got hit actually, I think, last year with the delays to the CP7. And then recently bought a specialist business in electricity, overhead cable sort of like services. How do you see this one? It's sort of recovered from the dip it had last year, I think.
Yeah, it's one of these businesses that's got one of the most enviable track records on public markets in the UK. Looking at sort of how they're compounding and creating value. I mean, Paul has done a phenomenal job here, growing this business, adding key verticals, and really created so much value for shareholders, which is really good to see. We've been investors for a very long time. I think largest investors in this company, and as you say, really geared into essential maintenance, which is so desperately needed, be it water. I mean, every week you're reading a new headline about water companies needing to get their act together and maintaining that infrastructure, rail, nuclear, decommissioning, and environment, as well as if they've entered sort of that space as well, which I think is really, really a growth driver for the company. We're big fans of the company and of the team, and it's done well for investors over a long, long period of time.
Yeah.
It's one of these great compounders, growing its divvy, growing its earnings, and still it's trading on 12 times, continue to deliver. So it's a really nice business. It's been a really nice compounder for us over a long period of time. And really just solving important problems and doing that really well, treating its work base really well, taking care of all stakeholders. And then that's sort of been the recipe for this performance, I think.
Yeah, I think where people have wrongly labelled it is as a sort of like a, you know, as a contractor, whereas this is basically repeat recurring revenue streams for a thing that hasn't got that cyclical element to it. It's stuff that has to be done rather than this project related.
Yeah, no, I agree, and it's higher quality than sort of that contractor label, I think, that it gets sometimes.
Brilliant. Okay. Well, thanks everyone for your questions and thanks for your insight. But before we leave, Dominic, as I ask all my experts, is there sort of like one or a couple of stock ideas that people should put onto their watch list for the next 12 months, etc.? Either could be something we've talked about in the, you know, earlier in the last 55 minutes, or alternatively other stocks that you'd like to sort of like highlight.
Yeah. So I think this time I'd pick Bloomsbury. Publisher,
yeah.
Focusing professional, academic, and consumer. I think incredible value of the IP that it has. The shares have sort of sold off a lot over fears in sort of the academic side because the Trump administration has clamped down on funding for those types of publishers. And you had a change of CFO, and the CFO was really well liked by the city, I think. So that sort of course has to stop where it is. But fundamentally, I think they've started to monetize their academic content as well through AI licensing. They just got their first deal, which caused an upgrade of the shares, which I think is a step in the right direction. I think there's huge untapped opportunity in that division from that side. It's sort of 12 times PE, paying you 3%. And then you've got a really underpriced, in my opinion, consumer opportunity where you've going to get new releases, you're going to get a new Harry Potter show, which drives book sales as well, typically. And I think these are such lasting IPs, and they're just very, very cheap at the moment relative to the quality and the incredibly diverse author base that this company has. And I think they've been so brilliant at growing authors across different niches, building a really unique academic portfolio, and sort of buying that on 12 times here over the next year, I think is really exciting. So that would be my sort of favorite stock for the next 12 months I've picked.
Good. How resilient is that sort of the academic and professional sort of like division, which is about a third of the revenues, I think, to AI in terms of, obviously it's sold, it's like licensing deal, which is great. So that's a tick in the box. It's a beneficiary. But in terms of, you know, the AI, particularly open AI, you know, sort of ChatGPT using agent mode, is becoming deeper than anybody ever thought, to a certain extent, which potentially could undermine some of the exclusive data that they have in there. Well, what's your sort of like your feel for it?
Well, I think that's what's represented. I think that it's priced for a lot of disruption, and that's going to be the key question, whether it is or whether it's not, and that's sort of the trade that you do on that side of the business. I do think that a source of truth and of high quality data is incredibly important, and this is what Bloomsbury has, and it can continue to be levered in a effective way going forward, and I think there will be a demand for it going forward. How it's going to be expressed, we're going to see, but I'd be on the more optimistic side towards the value of this. I think an interesting one to look at is just Pearson as a result of it, and see that, like, you can sort of track Pearson and make a thesis versus, you know, where they sit relative to that and how AI is impacting that business.
I think with the... Yeah, I think you're right. And with the shares so lowly valued at the moment, effectively the share price is underpinned by the consumer division. You know, if not, the consumer division is worth more than the current share price, and therefore you get all the professional academic division for free anyway.
I think the consumer division, I think in terms of it's underpriced in terms of some of the franchises that are doing new publications over the next 2 years. I think I think it's undervalued relative to that.
Yeah. No, you're right.
Plus also it's a super consolidating sector. I mean, like we've seen, and I think anyway, it's a real jewel in the market in terms of the quality and the sort of culture and the sort of cultural impact it has as well in terms of the IP that it stewards.
Yeah, there's still plenty of money in literature and storytelling, that's for sure. Okay, thanks very much, Dominic. Really brilliant comments there, and thanks everyone for your questions. And look forward in touching base in another sort of like 6 to 12 months, and hearing about your next sort of big top tick. And if Bloomsbury could be anything like Boku, then people will make out like bandits. So thanks again, Dominic.
Well, really great to be on. Thank you. Thank you for all the questions as well. Really enjoyable, as always. Thank you.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.